and would continue to use my capital dollars to fund facilities for youth, families, it's seniors, libraries, parks, and technology for every school in Manhattan. That's why students, even those that didn't live in my district, got laptops and free broadband when the pandemic started and Delancey never Street, fell you know. In my first year, I will clean up the borough with a large covered trash can on every corner so and make sure every student has a laptop under a law that I propose. Gail Brewer to help close the digital divide, try to eliminate the homeless and tell me what and really start building towards racial and economic equality.
Brad.
Thank you. You know, it's about working in partnership, Arthur, with Albany in so many ways. You know, there are 238 million reasons to support increased taxes. By the way, 238 million, that's how much Ken Griffin's second apartment cost. And we obviously have to tax these oligarchs who have second and third homes. I'm getting so much pushback, and thank you for mentioning
We're picking
that.
Up the broadcast of the Manhattan Borough President Candidate Forum. Stay tuned.
Because they know that we are leaving money on the table every year. These are oligarchs from all across the country and the world who aren't paying their fair share. And they are gaining an incredible investment advantage by using New York State's laws and fire and safety. Yet they're paying the same effective tax rate as a single family homeowner in Queens. That is certainly worthy of change. And that's what we're trying to do in Albany, as well as raise the personal income tax and find other revenue sources. The last thing we need right now is an austerity budget. One, because it slows down the economy, and two, because it hurts the people who need our help the most.
Kim.
Thank you. So I would say that my perspective is a little bit different because I am a small business owner and I'm married to a small business owner. And I live in the life of a regular New Yorker dealing with vulnerable people on fixed incomes and working in the gig economy and really, really suffering right now. One of the things that we find most frustrating, yes, progressive taxation and closing loopholes and fighting for budget justice in terms of revenues. But there is also a big question in regular New Yorkers' minds about how we could spend as much money as we do in this city and see so much decay and decline in the quality of our lives. The budget has gone up over 30% over the last 8 years. What do we have to show for it? Starting at the top with, you know, payrolls that have increased, excessive six-figure executives and middlemen and consultants and contracts with various private and nonprofit contract deals that, you know, are very comfortable for a lot of people. Maybe no one is walking away with fancy, you know, cars and corruption isn't, afoot here, but there is a real, it's not austerity to be disciplined in our fiscal management. And one of the things that I want to do is shine a light on how we spend money in the public school system. The budget, which I'm very familiar with, is one key area where we need to look closely.
And Lindsay, budget justice.
So I agree with Brad on this one. We can't have an austerity budget. That's not the way to move forward from this moment. We need both the wealth tax and increase in graduated income tax and taxing our wealthiest in every possible way that's feasible because we have a huge budget shortfall. And I happened to, when I worked for the state, negotiate on behalf of the governor's office the budget for our team in economic development and housing portfolios. So I know intimately how these tables work. And I think there's a real opportunity in this particular moment with having a supermajority, as you will, of the Democrats. The state budget, typically the way it's written up is a power grab for the governor. And I think this is maybe the one time where we can push back, and he's going to have to push back. And I will be doing that. And I would also say that there's always this kind of song and dance about foundation aid and how much money New York City schools and our New York City schools children are owed, and they're not getting their fair share. And a lot of that begins and ends in Albany. We cannot have package delivery, taxes, the kinds of things that hurt our most vulnerable people in this city. We need tax on our wealthiest, and we can't have an austerity budget.
All right, now we're going to talk about community boards. So community boards are local appointed advisory groups that represent various diverse community districts. They advise on many things, among them land use and zoning. Therefore, it is extremely important that as many voices from these communities are heard, since their decisions directly impact their livelihood. So what steps will you take to make the Manhattan Community Board's membership more accessible to working class New Yorkers? How will you address concerns of lack of community representation in community boards across Manhattan? And we're going to start with Ben.
Thank you. I got my start on Community Board 8, Manhattan, when Scott Stringer first appointed me. I think that I've proven that when elected officials support their community boards, we can be unstoppable. That's why I funded urban planners for my boards, and this year, every board in Manhattan, to empower communities to stand up to developers. I also worked with Manhattan Borough President Gail Brewer to introduce and pass a resolution that allowed teens on community boards. Boards can be stagnant and over time become less representative of their communities. The board where I have the most appointments has seen high turnover because I've been willing to take off people who stopped participating or even showing up. Appointing new members from high school, union members, retirees, where people of color have better representation. The board has a new face, and now it's fighting for affordable housing, good union jobs, and safe streets for cyclists and pedestrians. In my first term in the city council and later in the Charter Revision Commission, I proposed urban planners and term limits for board members. I also proposed transparency around community board appointments. Voters overwhelmingly approved my proposal. Taken together, we are empowering our boards to take on developers and ensuring that their diversity will reflect the communities they are appointed to represent.
Thank you. Up next, Kim.
Thank you so much. I think I'm the only candidate running for borough president that hasn't served on a community board. I, as you know, serve on the Community Education Council. I find that this is an interesting question, and I talk to students in District 3. We have a student member on the Community Education Council, and I know we have recently started putting younger members onto community boards. Students are really interested in being more involved, and they have lots of questions about the integrity of a process that puts so much responsibility on individuals who are appointed by elected officials, rather than actually electing them through the community. So I think that there is a big question about representation, about equity on community boards, about how we appoint members, and or whether or not we could be we could elect members of community boards at some point in the future. I think that there are a lot of individuals that would like to see us use more technology and be more transparent in the processes so that meetings are more palatable and people can devote more time from their homes. So I'm willing and open to explore lots of different issues, but I definitely think that we need to strike a balance between the ability for people to participate and actively engage, and then the sort of the requisite responsibilities and power that community boards are afforded in the government.
Thanks, Kim. Up next, Elizabeth.
Great, thanks. I have a lot to say about this. I'm the longest serving community board chair, I think, in this meeting tonight. And my feeling on community boards is multiple fold. We are working very hard on the community boards to try to make sure that we, and I've done this. I've done this several throughout my career. Throughout my 10 years on Community Board 7, we've created a NYCHA task force that brought in social justice and brought in NYCHA members. It was the first time the community board had ever done that, I think, in the history of Manhattan. We also brought in several reforms that I think, I believe strongly in term limits for community board members. I think we have, during my time on the community board, we had, people have served for life. I think 10 years is a very important resource that we need to have. We need to make sure that we include term limits for community board members. I also think that community boards are really the lifeblood of our city. And during my 3 years, the longest serving term as a community board on the Upper West Side, we negotiated everything from bike lanes to safe streets to housing. And those are things that we need to continue in this new era. And as your borough president, I will do that. So thanks.
Up next, Lindsay.
So I kind of want to back up what Erica is saying in the chat. One of the most, one of the good things of this very difficult year is that more people have been able to engage in the community board process and, you know, committee review process than ever before. You know, I've got a 6-year-old. A lot of people have kids or caregiving responsibilities. So it blocks out an entire segment of their life by decades in many cases that couldn't serve on these boards. Equally, as Erica said in the chat, it's very hard for people with mobility issues to engage on the same level. And I think we have to learn from this moment in time where we're all remote to incorporate opportunities moving forward and backed up with grants from the Manhattan Borough President's Office to ensure that we can include members that have either mobility issues or caregiving issues and have to be remote members. I think we have to use this very challenging time where we've seen the test and it works to find more diversity in the people we can engage. And we started the question with talking about working families and how do we engage more diversity on these boards, make it possible for people to be a part of them if they don't have the luxury of going to a specific place for a whole evening and being away from either their family or a long work shift. So I think that's probably the biggest key shift that we could make in this moment in time is to learn from what's worked and what hasn't about remote attendance and incorporate that moving forward once we're past this pandemic in a way that still has in-person meetings but enables people to be a part of it remotely. I think that's huge.
Maria, I'm just going to break in for 1 second. I just want everybody to know this forum is now being broadcast live on WBAI-FM, which I produced a show at for a long time. And just for the people who are listening to WBAI, we are in the midst of a series of questions to the 6 borough president candidates, which are Ben Kalos, Kim Watkins, Elizabeth Caputo, Lindsay Boylan, Mark Levine, and Brad Hoylman, and they are presently answering a question about community boards, and other questions will follow over the next 50 minutes. And if you want to get online, if it's possible to find it and submit a question, please feel free to do so. And I'm not sure how you do that, but anyway, thank you for listening. Go ahead, Maria, I'll hand it back to you.
All right. Thanks, Arthur. And now back to community boards. It's your turn, Mark.
Well, thank you, Maria. And hello to all our listeners on WBAI. I had the privilege of serving for 5 years on Community Board 12, chaired the Traffic and Transportation Committee. And as council member, I appoint to CBs 7, 9, and 12. And I'm a huge believer in the power of community board and the power of a good board to stand up to entrenched powerful interests like big real estate. And it's one of the reasons why I stood with Gail Brewer against REBNY to fight against term limits for board members, because there are experts there who over years and years of work have developed the ability to go toe to toe with high paid landlord attorneys, and we need them in there. Boards must be representative of their communities. I'm really proud that I have appointed 65% of my appointments have been people of color during my 7 years in office, but we need to do more. We need to up representation of young people, of union members, of small business owners, of people with disabilities. And I'll tell you, if you filled out a community board application, you know, there's a very long list of questions. They ask you almost everything about their life, your life. But I want to add one more question, which is whether or not you own a car. Because I do feel that people who rely on mass transit or getting around by bike or as pedestrians are underrepresented on their boards. And I think that question on the application would help ensure we have diversity of all types. And finally, and my time's up, but more to come on how I want to empower boards. Maybe that'll be the next question. Thank you.
Thanks. And next we have Brad.
Thank you so much. You know, Community boards are our town halls. I rely on them. They are the eyes and ears of our local districts. I served on one for years with Arthur, and it was really the highlight of my public service in many respects. The Zoom generation has enabled us to work from home, and it does remind me of a cartoon I saw recently where two folks are on the couch with their computers open, and one looks to the other and says, I have an impending feeling of Zoom. We do spend a lot of time on Zoom, but the next borough president needs to set targets. Beta NYC released an excellent report on how representative the boards are, and it showed that we're underrepresenting Latino and Asian Manhattan residents. We have to fix that. You know, we only have two transgender community board members borough-wide. We have a gender parity between men and women borough-wide. That needs to change. And it's no surprise that our community boards skew older, so we have to fix that too. I was proud as a state senator to co-sponsor legislation to allow community board members to be under 18 years old. I also carried legislation to allow 16-year-olds to vote in the state of New York. We have to listen to those young voices. And last but not least, we need more public housing residents on our board. Gail has done an amazing job in making this more reflective in my district, but the issues facing public housing are too grave for us to have anything less than an extremely strong presence on our community boards.
Thank you. Now onwards to Arthur with the next question.
Okay, and I appreciated that discussion, having been on a board for 24 years. And I also want to just throw in that I think our current mayor is probably the least responsive mayor I ever experienced with respect to community boards in the cities in my time of paying attention. Our next question is about housing. We live in a borough which may be the centerpiece of gentrification. Neighborhoods which were once affordable, like Greenwich Village and Chelsea, have become unaffordable. Neighborhoods like Harlem and Washington Heights are quickly becoming gentrified. NYCHA developments, which over 8% of New Yorkers live in, continue to deteriorate. The much-reported lead paint cover-up is just the tip of the iceberg. Buildings are generally in a state of collapse with leaks, waste system backups, vermin, mold, broken elevators, and compactors being more common than not. The only answer from the current city leadership seems to be mandatory inclusionary housing and upzoning and use of median area income. The borough president has a major role to play in land use policy. How would you, as borough president, address these issues? Brad, you're first.
Thank you, Arthur. There's probably no more important issue than the affordable housing crisis and the disparity among the very wealthy and the poor, and the fact that so many of our constituents are having to move out of Manhattan over the years. Whether you're old or very young, it's very difficult to live in. I think we have an enormous opportunity given the pandemic, which is around housing, because we have 20 million square feet of empty office space in Midtown. And I really want to work with local boards, namely Community Board 5, to figure out if we can repurpose those empty office buildings for both affordable and supportive housing. The homelessness crisis is greater than at any point since the Great Depression, and that is a national disgrace on New York. Boards need to be involved at the ground level. I'm sad that the borough president's idea for pre-planning in ULURPS didn't work out, but we know that when communities are involved early on, it's a better project. And then finally, mandatory inclusionary housing, it's not good enough. 75-25, 80-20, not good enough. We can't have housing being driven by the market. We need social housing. We need more Penn Souths. We need more independent plazas. And we need to make sure that we have the wherewithal and the revenue to do that.
Next, Lindsay.
So this current mayor has basically contemplating trying to get more housing through upzoning. And I think that that has been a tremendous failure, not only because 9 out of the 10 last contemplated zonings have been in largely low-income communities of color, which is an unfair burden and means that people end up having things done to them instead of being part of a process. I think we have to completely revamp the zoning process and build in this city and in this borough specifically around our goals, around our housing goals, and not just affordable housing, but deeply affordable housing and senior housing. I mean, some of the people experiencing the most poverty, high poverty rates in this borough are seniors. And it's simply because they're on a fixed income and they don't qualify for, or there isn't enough senior housing available. I'm someone, unlike some of the members on this group, who does not agree with RAD and privatization of public housing as a way forward. It's just not feasible because that means we don't have public housing in the future. That means we don't have that to rely on. If we want the next generation of public housing and social housing, we need a whole host of tools to throw at this. And as you mentioned in your question, Arthur, mandatory inclusionary housing doesn't cut it alone. We need a lot more housing, and we need a lot more housing at different income levels, because there's a lot of need at different income levels up to workforce housing. You know, more than 50% of our people are severely rent burdened. And that means a lot of different people for a lot of different reasons can't afford to live here. And that means we need to be building a lot more housing based around our goals, and probably throwing more money at that as well.
Kim Watkins.
Thank you. So the first thing that I think I want to emphasize are the words both Lindsay and Brad used, which were plans and goals. The planning process is not a planning process. There is no true planning process for development of our housing stock in this city in earnest. And we're not thinking about it from the perspective of what the goals should actually be. There are a couple of other factors that we need to think about. We need more green space in Manhattan. We need to make sure that there's a capacity to build where there isn't a food insecurity issue, where there isn't a food desert, as they call it. We need to build where there's access to clean water, where there's access to transit, where there is access to other elements of the quality of life that people deserve to live near. I think part of the issue that I would like to tackle as Manhattan Borough President is to prioritize some of the housing conversations that we have in terms of essential workers having to live so far away from where they perform their duties as teachers, as school nurses, as firefighters and other first responders. No one can afford to live in Manhattan when they work, when they're not paid a living wage that's comparable to what housing costs. And even the most affordable units in the developments that we've seen of late, as we know, are not truly affordable housing. So that's one main priority. Just the second priority would be to increase home ownership, because at 20%, Manhattan is the worst in the country, and we need to fix that as well.
Ben Kalos, housing.
Welcome to our WBAI listeners. I'm Councilmember Ben Kalos, co-chair of the Progressive Caucus, and a tenant in a market-rate one-bedroom. We've got an affordable housing crisis that never seems to go away, despite generations of politicians promising to do something about it. That's why I've always refused real estate money. All I want is for people who live here to be able to stay here and not to have to be forced out because they can no longer afford it. I know it sounds simple, but that's the problem, and that's just one of the things that keeps me up at night. When greedy landlords took billions in tax breaks from politicians that they gave big checks to without registering the affordable housing they promised, I wrote the law to get hundreds of thousands of affordable homes back on the market. In my district, we built and preserved over 1,000 affordable apartments. And with 18,000 children who woke up in a homeless shelter this morning, with 17,000 family members, they are the face of homeless in our city. That's why I founded the Eastside Task Force for Homeless Outreach and Services with Borough President Gail Brewer to do our part to help. And we've built supportive housing all over the district, including across the street from where I live. Where others see a dead or dying city, pointing to vacant apartments as proof, I see more vacancies than homeless families and the opportunity to house them all now, which is why I proposed it in an op-ed. Tomorrow, I'm co-sponsoring legislation with Speaker Cory Johnson to mandate citywide comprehensive plan so every neighborhood does their fair share and that they can lead the rezoning process as opposed to having a profit-driven rezoning.
Sorry.
We can make an affordable housing mandatory everywhere in Manhattan and welcome the homeless in off the streets as our neighbors.
Elizabeth Caputo.
Sure. Might hopefully off of mute.
Sorry.
We heard you.
Great. So hi, WBAI. Look, I've lived and rented here for 25 years, my entire adult life in New York City. And I could not believe more that we need qualified new leadership for this city. Legislation hasn't cut it. Leadership does. New York City is in an affordable housing crisis right now, and our current leaders have failed to provide support. We need all districts to do their part in thinking through, in particular, affordable housing. I'm really glad that the folks on this call have talked about it, but I just want to let you know that it's not enough. And in terms of what we need, Manhattan, it's clear that we need an increased number of affordable rent units. 44% of New York households are rent unburdened. They pay more than 30% of their income towards rent. We're a city of islands, and we need changes to zoning. And I'm going to be your candidate as borough president. It is conscientious towards the environmental, racial, and social concerns of this neighborhood. Thanks.
Last, Mark Levine. Let's talk about housing.
Thank you, Arthur. We have an affordable housing emergency here in New York City, and Manhattan is its epicenter. And we need dramatic action. We need to significantly increase the capital budget that this city is investing in affordable housing, now at about $5 billion over our four-year capital plan. And we can do it if we increase taxes on millionaires and billionaires. That's one of the biggest reasons why I think we need more progressive taxation. And bringing in more money for affordable housing development to pursue 100% affordable models allows us to pursue things, and I agree with Brad on this, like social housing, which is affordable in perpetuity, to push innovative models like community land trusts, where the land itself is not owned by a developer, public or private, but by residents themselves. Community land trusts are working in neighborhoods around the city. We can do more to grow and nurture them. It's shameful that we have neglected NYCHA, the affordable housing we do have with a $30 billion backlog in repairs. And finally, the most cost-effective thing we can do is to help vulnerable tenants remain in the homes that they do have. And it's why I want to accelerate the implementation of our historic right to counsel law in New York City so that every zip code in Manhattan is ready with an attorney for any tenant who would face an eviction proceeding, particularly in the weeks and months ahead as we face a possible eviction avalanche because of this pandemic. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. And just for our, I have to do this radio thing, just for our listeners, we are, you're listening to a debate, a forum with the six candidates for Manhattan Borough President for an election that's being held on June 22nd, that's being sponsored by a number of organizations, including Our Revolution, New York Progressive Action Network, Indivisible, and the 504 Democratic Club. And so the next question is going to be asked by the president of the 504 Democratic Club, Michael Schweinsberg. Michael.
You're on mute there, Mike.
Bottom left corner to unmute yourself.
Thank you kindly. As I was saying, thank you all for attending this evening, both the audience and the candidates and the WBAI listenership. My question is a two-part question with a bit of a preface. People with disabilities are the largest minority and also the poorest minority. We are totally intersectional and can be found in every single segment of society in every nation in the world. In the 28 midterms, we became the second largest voting bloc, and that continued in 2020. Yet, with very few exceptions, when was the last time you heard a candidate or an elected official mention people with disabilities, even when they are enumerating all the marginalized communities they seek to protect? Likewise, when they are speaking of their opposition to the isms, sexism, classism, racism, etc. When have you heard them mention ableism? We face blatant discrimination in employment, housing, transportation, in education, and healthcare, and in funding for necessary programs and funding for students with disabilities in our colleges and universities, which has remained stagnant since 1992. We need elected officials to stand with us and fight alongside us. Will you commit to inclusion of disability rights as part of your platform, on your website, and in all campaign literature you produce? Second part, will you commit to appointing qualified members of the disability community to community boards throughout Manhattan whenever and wherever possible? Thank you kindly.
All right, so we're going to start with Lindsay.
Sure. Well, thank you so much, Mike, for that question, and I really appreciate it. I did mention mobility when we were talking about the subways earlier. This couldn't be more vital. The most heartbreaking thing that I see in the public realm that's being built now is how inaccessible a lot of it is and how much money is going to inaccessible public cultural institutions and spaces that continue to be built that don't accommodate people with various, you know, mobility issues, for one. And I think we need to incorporate issues of mobility in any kind of, for instance, capital project that the city is engaged in this borough, but beyond. Every part of my campaign reflects consideration of disability issues. As someone who comes from a family of multi-generational mental illness as a disability, that component of disability is a very personal part of my passion and my policy, knowing that mental illness is the biggest cause of disability in the workplace worldwide. So that's really in my DNA, how I approach all of this. And as someone who spent my first decade in planning, urban planning, a lot of my work in public parks was, how great can your park be if the bathroom can't accommodate a wheelchair to turn 360 around? How great of a public space do you have if people can't get inside? So, you know, and I think you said in this last election, that's the second or one of the biggest voting blocks. I've seen the political power really grow very recently, and it's incredible. It's one of the most moving things I've seen. I will be not just in my campaign, but when I become borough president, it will be a key part of my staffing and everything I do with policy and in our DNA.
Next, we have Ben.
Thank you. I want to thank the 504 Democrats and Michael Schweinsberg. You guys endorsed me back in 2013 when I was a long shot candidate, and we've been collaborating ever since. One of the best moments of my life is marching in the disability in the first annual Disability Pride Parade with you and other organizers on the anniversary of the ADA. The Mayor's Office for People with Disabilities has me on speed dial, and I've been there for anything and everything, including trying to make sure that our bike share system has accessible bikes, and I even learned how to ride in one of those. I've been prioritizing accessibility since I've gotten to the council, starting work curb cuts, and the fact that so many of our curb cuts were not accessible. I introduced legislation. We didn't actually end up passing it because the Center for the Independence Disabled in New York sued and won. We've been working on a project to make storefronts accessible with 504 Democrats since I've been elected. We just introduced it. And what it would do is make grants and loans available to businesses to make their buildings and storefronts ADA accessible, including for the coronavirus. And in exchange, it would actually require the landlord to give folks a lower rent or even renew their lease. And I think just another key piece is on affordable housing. We've been going after the mayor who keeps building affordable housing that is inaccessible because somehow that's legal. I will include disability on my website. We will make sure to update it as soon as possible, as many of our campaign materials as we can. I will always answer your questions. And in terms of community board appointments, I've already done it. I will continue to do it. And I will increase representation beyond mobility disability to include broader neurodiversity and a lot of the unseen.
Time.
Thanks, Ben. Next, we have Kim.
Thank you so much. This is an issue that's near and dear to my heart as well. I live with a disability. I have epilepsy, and so it's not a physical disability, but it is a disability that is it affects my day-to-day life. So it is something that is in the forefront of my mind frequently. It is also something that I think about in terms of the public school system, echoing some of the comments about mass transit and about accessible housing, the public school system. It is embarrassing that such a small percentage, I think it's less than 10% of our public schools, are ADA compliant. And in some cases, the Band-Aid position is to put a ramp at the entrance, but that's it. Then the school is technically partially compliant, but nothing inside of the building is actually compliant. Museums, cultural institutions, and public parks, all of which need to be rethought in terms of the natural course of human life and our ability to interact and be humans, regardless of our physical and mental capabilities. So I will say that yes to the website and materials. I actually just wrote a blog post on this, and yes, of course, to diversity on community boards with disabled individuals.
Up next, Mark.
Thank you, Maria. And thank you, Mike, for raising this important question and for your decades of leadership in the fight against ableism in this city. You know, the barriers that New Yorkers with disabilities face are the result of policy failures and failures of investment. And therefore, we can fix them with smart policy and the right investments. And it's something I've been working on since my first day in the council. Actually, the first bill I passed, which I co-sponsored with Gail Brewer, dramatically expanded the pace at which the city is installing audible pedestrian signals to make it easier for people with visual and cognitive impairments to cross the street. I'm really proud of a project we've done in my district to rebuild a playground, Bloomingdale Playground. And Elizabeth, you were huge in this fight as well. It is entirely universally accessible so that children can play together, whether they happen to use a wheelchair or other mobility device, or whether they have any other challenges. It's really beautiful. Come by and check it out on the Upper West Side. I think that we have a lot of work to do on employment justice for people with disabilities, and something that I'm really committed to working on as borough president. The unemployment rate among New Yorkers with disabilities, it's over 2/3, and I'm talking about people who are ready, willing, and able to work. That's just inexcusable. And this pandemic has proven that you can telecommute and do your job accessibly. Successfully. So let's offer that as a reasonable accommodation. Let's have laws in place that protect against ableism in the workplace, that guarantee reasonable accommodations using technology where appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you. Up next, Brad.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you, Arthur, for your lawsuit against the MTA on accessibility at subway stations. That was very important. And I look to you, Michael, but also an individual, a constituent of mine named Tass Somoza. She's a remarkable young woman who lives in Hell's Kitchen. She talks about an inclusion revolution that we need to undertake. And she works, and she's such an inspiration at the international level to make sure that children born with disabilities aren't given up for adoption or abandoned, worse in some countries. We have a long way to go. Just in my district, on 23rd Street, there's a major bridge across the FDR that isn't wheelchair accessible. Of course, we know about our subway stations and the 1/3 of the elevators at any given time don't work. But we also talk about the fact that our healthcare system isn't treating folks with disabilities fairly, and the fact that people who are immunocompromised are vulnerable if folks don't get vaccinated. We need public health policies that protect them as too. And let me just say that this is, you know, so important that the next borough president use this as a platform. You certainly have my commitment to make sure that folks with disabilities are appointed to community boards and their voices are heard, and that all my materials are inclusive so we can begin this inclusive revolution.
Thank you. And next, Elizabeth.
Sure. Thanks, everyone. I hope I'm still on and can be heard. Thank you, Mark, for your comments. I think the best thing I can say tonight is one of my lifelong works as chair of Committee Board 7, which was really leading the charge that led to a redesign of the Bloomingdale Playground. That was an aging space on Amsterdam Avenue between 104th and 105th that made and really transformed how our city worked to make, and it was really the truly first citywide accessible and inclusive playground. I am quite proud of that work. It led to getting approved by the city council, thanks to our city council members, many of whom are on this call. But the design and the sort of discussion about it really started at the community board level and at the local level with the community board and with me. And I believe very strongly about encouraging play for children who have different needs. And it was first of its kind, and I will continue to do that as the borough president. I feel very strongly about this. And again, just as it pertains to recruiting people for Community Board 7, community boards across the borough, I have prioritized that my entire career as a board chair, and I will continue to do it. But that's something I hold as a cornerstone to my time as a community board chair, and we'll do that and accelerate it throughout the borough as your
Thank you. I'll hand it off to Arthur to go to the next question.
Right. And again, for those listening on WBAI, we're having a borough president forum with six candidates who are running in the June 22nd election. There are questions being asked of them, and they're each answering them. They have 1.5 minutes. One of the sponsors of tonight's forum is Black Lives Matter of Greater New York, and they submitted the following question. Manhattan has been the focal point of a lot of protests in 2020. Many of the protesters were brutalized by police. We saw the use of kettling. We saw people shoved and attacked by police for just being present. We saw curfews which gave the police license to arrest whom they pleased. Some have likened images of New York City this summer to those of Selma in the 1960s. In the midst of these protests, three separate drivers intentionally drove their cars into protesters. These attacks have never amounted to any serious charges against the police officers involved. Not a public reckoning about the police, nor a public reckoning about the police tactics. There were enraged statements, but little was done. What would you do as borough president to address police brutalization of peaceful protesters, and how do you feel about what occurred? Kim, you're first.
Wow. The first thing that I want to say is that I'm outraged by what I saw and lightly participated in as a mother who lives in Harlem and is very active in my community with other public school parents and activists. The center point and the filter through which we have to see a reckoning in the operations of police departments, not just in New York City, but around this country, is understanding that it is racism began policing, essentially. And we need to stop thinking about the attempt to identify crime before it happens and subject people to the surveillance and tactics that we've seen demonstrated through the entire history of this country, and start thinking about what we need from our community in terms of basic public safety and also treating people humanely. So there have been a lot of inroads in terms of the talking points in racial justice and criminal justice reform. I'm proud to support those measures, and I would continue to use the Manhattan Borough's office to ensure that we look at the NYPD fairly and obviously defunding the police. And please, 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 we need to get police out of our public schools.
Elizabeth Caputo.
Thank you. So look, I mean, the first thing is that we need to divest funds from police departments. I think Kim has already mentioned that. We need to reallocate them to non-policing forms of public safety and community support. That's first and foremost, we need to emphasize the legal right to peaceful protest. Many of us did peaceful protests throughout the summer. I think we did that in a safe and equitable way. And we need to protect the Black Lives Matter, the BLM protesters. I feel very strongly in that. And we need to protect demonstrators at all costs. They have that right. I also believe, you know, we've had a lot of conversations, those of us who have been in the race for this, for a president's race for a long time, to talk about things like the closing of Rikers Island. I believe that's been delayed for far too long. I believe that New York needs to end the legacy of this prison, and each borough needs to do its part in building a smaller, smarter facilities that support inmate rehabilitation. I also believe that we will benefit greatly from divesting funds from police departments, as I said before. I just want to reiterate that, and reallocating them to non-policing forms of public safety and community support, including social services, healthcare, and other community resources that can really build back this borough. Thank you.
Ben Kalos, talk about the police.
Hard to imagine real racial justice with an NYPD commissioner who won't say that Black Lives Matter. It's hard to imagine real racial justice when we have a city more interested in policing communities of color rather than investing in them. When thousands of people took to the streets to demand that the city council hold the NYPD accountable, I listened. I'm the only one in this race who has ever voted to defund the NYPD. Now, defunding the NYPD is more than just a slogan. It's how we pay for the positive change we want to see in our communities that have been harmed by over-policing. Now, once we acknowledge the problem of communities being over-policed, it will be easier to see the steps in fixing it. For me, it starts with education, giving every single child access to the internet, giving students history books that don't just have stories of white men and colonizers, investing in small businesses owned by people of color, especially women, and ending mass incarceration over policing communities of color. We need to change how the criminal justice system treats white people differently than black and brown people who fill our jails. We need to change how it treats poor people and people who can afford pricey lawyers. The Paul Manafort's of this world experience a very different criminal justice system. That's just not acceptable. As your next borough president, I want to work with you to make sure we close down Rikers and completely change our criminal justice system.
Next, Mark Levine, talk about the police.
Thank you, Arthur, and thanks to Hawk Newsom and Black Lives Matter of Greater New York just for years of leadership, way before this issue reached the level of mass attention that it got this year. And yes, you're absolutely right. The behavior of the NYPD towards protesters this summer was just indefensible. The New York Times documented something like 80 cases of police violence that were recorded on video. And in virtually every instance, these were perpetrated against peaceful protesters. Now, the responsibility of that, of course, directly lies with the mayor and the police commissioner. But also, this is a reflection of the broken system for accountability we have for police misconduct. There have been virtually no consequences meted out to the officers, including the drivers that you mentioned in your question, for acts of violence. And it's because we have given the police commissioner the sole ability to overrule recommendations of punishments as determined by the CCRB. This is indefensible and it must be fixed. We need a system for applying punishments to officers who commit misconduct that is beyond the control of the police commissioner. And I have a variety of ideas on how that plan could be implemented, but to continue with the status quo in which officers who have committed fireable offenses are still on the force is unacceptable.
Oh, Brad Hoylman, talk about the police. I was muted.
Thank you. Yes. It's worth, you know, acknowledging that all the candidates for borough president are white. And I think that's reflective of the racial disparities in our borough. First, let me start with Commissioner Shea. He should be fired. He does not have the confidence of the city council. He does not have the confidence of New Yorkers, and certainly, I think, of the state legislature. I appreciate so greatly, you know, Hawk Newsom and everything that was done through Black Lives Matter. That was a groundswell moment that will live in history, and I'm so grateful to my colleagues that we went up to Albany and passed serious consequential police reforms like repealing 50A, which protected police records from the public and elected officials, and a bill that I had the honor of passing, the Police Statistics and Transparency Act, which for the first time will quantify who gets arrested, whether it's low crimes or who dies in custody. That's crucial that we have that data and understand how that works. Finally, we need a CCRB that's truly independent, and we need to fund it as such and ensure that the public and every community gets the real truth about what's happening in policing. We don't need helicopters hovering over Hell's Kitchen as they did a few months ago. Just because one person from Warriors in the Garden had barricaded himself in his room and knew enough that search warrant did not obligate him to open the door.
And Lindsay Boylan.
Sure. Well, thank you so much, Newsom Hawk. I think this is Hawk Newsom, excuse me. This is a wonderful question. I'm supportive of the defunding of the police movement. Before this was in much of a conversation this summer, I was talking about moving mental illness related emergencies away from the NYPD because it only causes more violence and death. I'm all for much more police accountability. I agree that Commissioner Shea needs to go yesterday. We also need to get under control and not treat the PBA like a union, because they're not. They're, preaching hate, frankly, and lack of accountability. We should have a publicly elected civilian complaint board membership instead of what we have, which needs a ton of reform at the CCRB. And we can close Rikers while also not opening new jails. I think that's very critical, especially if these continued moves for cash bail and all these other movements continue to move forward. Our jail population will continue to go down. And I think a lot of the over-policing just ends up producing just more people to be imprisoned. And it's the exact opposite way of what we should be doing. We should be reinvesting much more money in community-based solutions, housing solutions. And I think all of our land use decisions and processes should take into account racial impact as a part of that study for zoning, for ULURP processes and
time.
Beyond.
All right. We have reached the end of our 8 questions. We have had people monitoring the chat. We only have about 8 minutes left in this forum, and I'm going to turn it over to Rory and from 504 and Brian Mangan, who may have chosen one or two questions to pose to the candidates.
Hi, Arthur. Thanks a lot. First of all, thank you to everyone who participated tonight. The chat was very lively, and the Q&A, I have to say, I've done a bunch of these forums. This is by far the most educated, intelligent, and incisive questions that I've seen. And thank you, of course, to the candidates who gave us an incredible, interesting, and informative forum tonight. I'm going to kick it over to Rory Monshine to ask the first question. I think we may only have time for one question. So, Rory, if you're ready, take it away. And thanks, everybody.
Sure. Hi, my name is Rory Monshine, and I'm the social media chair for 504 Democrats. Throughout the night, we've been monitoring the vibrant Facebook Live comments, and we've gotten a lot of great questions. But unfortunately, since we could only pick one, here is the one that we picked. Hudson McKinley, who's watching from the Upper West Side, wants to know, we hear so much about protecting small businesses, but not much about the people who work for small businesses. A $15 minimum wage is only about $25,000 a year, which is not enough to get by in Manhattan. What will you do to lower prices in housing and empower workers while still supporting small businesses? Thank you.
We're going to go to Elizabeth first on this one.
Sure. I mean, I actually was just talking to a small business owner tonight in the neighborhood who is dealing with exactly that issue. One of his owners has unfortunately died of COVID. And there is an incredible amount of work and issues that are going on right now with workers in the city. I have said repeatedly that I will prioritize that. I will mention it in my closing statement. I have done it throughout my time as an elected leader of Community Board 7, where we have prioritized small businesses and making sure that we work with them. I work very closely with the New York Hospitality Alliance. We are going to make sure that we make sure that these folks are covered throughout the coming months and years. And I will work with every bone in my body to make sure that happens.
Okay, next we're going to Brad.
Yes, thank you so much for the question. It's very pertinent. You know, I'm just putting the finishing touches on a report called Bleaker on Bleaker, where it shows that vacancy rates from a survey that I did in 2017 to this year for small businesses were up 284%. They are evaporating before our very eyes. I've introduced legislation called Save Our Storefronts. You can go to saveourstorefronts.nyc. I sound like a used car salesman. But if you go there, you'll see that it's a model where it's shared sacrifice between the small business owner and the landlord, where the small business owner only has to pay a certain percentage of her profits to the landlord. We piloted that program at Grand Central recently, and it worked extremely well. And I'm happy to say that a number of small businesses are surviving there, even though they don't have the foot traffic. We also have proposals for a vacancy tax that was mentioned recently in the New York Times, where landlords that are pushing small businesses out because they're holding out for what they call a creditworthy tenant should have to pay. There should be a disincentive for that. And then something that Gail Brewer pioneered on the Upper West Side that I'm sure Elizabeth knows about, called formerly retail zoning, is important. We got to keep the big chains at bay so our small businesses can survive. It's about equity for small businesses. It's about making sure that they can survive this difficult time. We're looking at one. Billionaires and billionaires.
And you're listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Please do stay tuned. And you have been listening to the Manhattan Borough President Forum here over listener-sponsored WBAI in New York. Oh, having one of these days. So we'll see if we can get this to play. You're listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Stay tuned for RPM, revolutions per minute.